Witnesses beginning from the sun god. Adharmaha. Deviation from the regulative principles. Vigataha. Is known. Stanam. The proper place. Dandasha. Of punishment. Yujate. Is accepted as. Sarve. All. Karma anurodena. With consideration of the activities performed. Dandam. Punishment. Arhanti. Deserve. Karinaha. The performers of sinful activities. So translation. The candidates for punishment are those who are confirmed by these many witnesses to have deviated from their prescribed regulative duties. Everyone engaged in fruitive activities is suitable to be subjected to punishment according to his sinful acts. You can repeat. The candidates for punishment are those who are confirmed
by these many witnesses
who have deviated from
their prescribed regulative duties.
Everyone engaged in fruitive activities. It's suitable to be subjected to punishment according to his sinful acts. So there's no purport to this text. We'll read the next text, which is 44. So, samvantehi badranihi viparitani chanakaha karinam guna sangosti dehavannahi yakarma krit. O inhabitants of Vaikuntha, you are sinless, but those within this material world are all karmis, whether acting piously or impiously. Both kinds of action are possible for them because they are contaminated by the three modes of nature and must act accordingly. One who has accepted a material body cannot be inactive, and sinful action is inevitable for one acting under the modes of material nature. Therefore, all the living entities within this material world are punishable. So, purport by His Divine Grace, Śrīla Prabhupāda, Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai. The difference between human beings and non-human beings is that a human is supposed to act according to the direction of the Vedas. Unfortunately, men manufacture their own ways of acting without reference to the Vedas. Therefore, all of them commit sinful actions and are punishable. All right. So, Om Agana Timiranda Shaganan Shada Shilakaya Chakshurun Meditam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruveda Maha. So there's several key phrases that I wanted to discuss here in the class. One, of course, is that without reference to the Vedas. Actually, there's many who make reference to the Vedas without understanding the purpose of the Vedas or without understanding what the Vedas say in the particular context. So that's under the same category, without reference to the Vedas. Or they interpret, just like there's two methods of what we call hermeneutics when dealing with the Vedas. One is called mukya, and the other one is gauna. Mukya means like the face, okay? And so mukya means the direct meaning of the Vedas, and gauna is the indirect meaning of the Vedas. In other words, taking things to be allegorical, metaphorical, a fairy tale, a story to teach you a certain lesson in life. And, I mean, this is quite prominent that people do this. Even sometimes we find, quote, bhaktas who do this too. It's very interesting. There's some devotees who have had some sort of crisis of faith, and they take many of the statements, especially the statements of the Vedas when dealing with the material world. They take those as metaphorical or nice stories or something like that. Especially the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, which is very hard for people to understand. Although one who has spiritual vision, they can understand it. One who doesn't have spiritual vision, it's just bewildering to the mind. Like Prabhupada said to the devotees who were attempting to understand the fifth canto, he said, you won't understand this. It's just like you require it. Prabhupada even brought in some sadhus from South India who were expert in Sanskrit to try to help the devotees understand the description of the universe from the fifth canto, but still it wasn't successful because you had to have a spiritual vision, a different dimensional understanding. Just like those of you who are interested in science fiction and things like that, there's different dimensions. And, you know, we're only seeing within a certain amount of dimensions. You know, of course, we see three dimensions, and we move in the fourth dimension, which is time. And there's our godbrother Satyaputta gave this example of certain entities, they only move in two dimensions, not all the time, but let's say an ant is moving in two dimensions, that means backwards and forwards, left and right, and not up and down at that particular point. And so, you know, then he's basically not able to understand something that's on the third dimension. And if you simply give a description, a two-dimensional description of something that exists on the third dimension, then you'll never get to that location. For example, if I say that there's a store or there's a person who lives in 55th Street and 8th Avenue in New York, but I don't tell you what story he's on, you know, he may be on the 20th story or the penthouse or something like that, then you'll never really be able to approach him. So there's a higher dimensional understanding contained in these descriptions in the Vedas. So what we have is the people, they take a certain approach and they say, well, when Krishna is talking about the material world, even though it doesn't really fit what I've experienced with my senses or the scientists have experienced with their extended senses, therefore it's just like metaphorical, you know, means something different. Okay. Of course, you know, if that enables them to approach Krishna consciousness rather than just giving up everything else, I guess it's a step forward, so to speak. Just like Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote two books to help people come to Krishna consciousness who couldn't have the faith in, you know, the descriptions of the material world or even in descriptions about Krishna's pastimes. He has two books, you know, the Bhagavat and, of course, Krishna Sangita. There's these two books written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, which are like bridge books, they're Krishna West books, in which he basically even talks about, in the Bhagavad, he talks about how the hells, he says, are metaphorical. You know, so then the devotees read this sometimes, and they say, well, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said the hells are metaphorical, they're not actual. And the Prabhupada says, they're actual, so how do you deal with these two things? Well, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur was doing some bridge preaching. You understand? Because he's, as I mentioned yesterday, because I've been studying about this, he was dealing with the Bhadraloka, which means the people who were very much into modern science, because at that time the philosophy or feeling was that through modern science there's so much advancement, we're becoming better, and then evolution became very prominent. Due to this great saint, Charles Darwin. I'm speaking facetiously. And, you know, so Darwin, of course, that was like it was origin of the species. Just like, in people's minds, it just really corroborated their understanding that everything's getting better. It's interesting, isn't it? So it fits in. You know, you wonder why Prabhupada really focused on Charles Darwin or evolution, because evolution is actually the philosophy of evolution is the foundation of the whole mood or feeling or belief that everything is getting better in society. You know, why would Prabhupada just like focus on evolution? Because if you take away that particular point, then the whole edifice of people's belief in society just falls apart, and then maybe they'll think of Krishna consciousness. Like everything's getting better. It's a bright new world. I remember these songs from the 1960s I mentioned yesterday in the World's Fair of 1964, whatever World's Fair. You probably went to the World's Fair too, no? Anyone here go to that World's Fair? You did. Isn't it? I mean, it was just like you were filled with an optimism, the unbelievable optimism. You know, if you got something wrong with your body, they're going to be able to replace the parts. And also, you know, even science fiction is like that. If you watch Star Trek or something like that, you know, you get sick, and they can put your brain on another person's body like they did with Spock at one time. You remember that? You don't remember that? Yeah, he remembers that. So Prabhupada. And another interesting point is about this optimism. You know, things are getting better. We're evolving. You know, the future. There was even a depiction like in the future we're going to have these much bigger brains. Like, I'm sure some of you have seen that. Like brains like about this big. You know, there were actually pictures of future men. And the brain was, and women too, sorry. And the brain was much bigger. And for one reason or other also that philosophy.
He was always bald though.
Yeah, he was always bald.
They couldn't figure out, I guess, how to make a good head of hair.
Yeah, you remember that. It was amazing. I was always completely bald and you could see the crevices in the skull. So in other words, with evolution, we lost our hair because hair was just like something from the apes, you know, the naked apes. Of course, there was that one book that was written in the 1950s or something, or 60s, the naked apes, that we were just like apes, and somehow or other we'd lost our hair, and we were walking upright. And he hasn't, but anyway. And things are getting, you know, things are getting better. Among some people, that fell out of favor, that particular philosophy, because it encouraged a type of racism, which is interesting. You understand? Then later on in the 90s or, yeah, in the 90s, then we were supposed to actually be worshiping the noble sages, the noble aborigines and things like that, how they were actually more advanced than us. So there was some discussion about that. But in any case, Prabhupada really stressed a lot on the Bhaktivedanta Institute and Sadaputta's work. Of course, Sadaputta, even before he became a devotee, he understood how or why evolution is impossible. You know, the survival of the fittest. Why it would be impossible? Because he analyzed it from a mathematical perspective. That is, what is the possibility of one species changing to another, or even like a mutation occurring that would allow species to be more, have a higher level of survivability. And by his mathematical analysis using what's called information theory, there's an interesting book written, ISKCON book about it. I forget the name of the book right now. But he showed it was actually basically impossible. Even for one creature to have been created out of nothing, it was mathematically impossible. Even within the span of millions of universes, you know, the time span of millions of universes. Anyway, so getting back to the point is Prabhupada really concentrated on this evolution point. And for a certain period, the devotees tried to work with the Christian creationists, who also concentrated on that. But the Christian creationists had sort of a fanatical approach, thinking that the whole world was created 5,000 years ago. And so it didn't really work. And also the Christian creationists thought that we were of the devil. When the devotees wrote, you know, originally like Sadaputta thought, you know, maybe we can work with these people. So he wrote to them and they wrote back to him, "You're the devil, we can't work with you." You know, Hare Krishna. So standard response. So Prabhupada really stressed on that. And nowadays, of course, the whole theory of evolution is gradually falling out of favor. They've come out with different other philosophies that maybe support the a modified theory of evolution, punctuated equilibrium. I mean, I'm not going to go through all these different theories. But in any case, Prabhupada stressed that. So because of our faith in modern science and ability to perceive things through the modern scientific instruments, sometimes devotees have these real crises of faith when approaching the Vedic literatures. So what they do sometimes is pick and choose. The point I'm talking about, and they say that, well, actually, you know, the whole description of the fifth canto is metaphorical, and, you know, maybe Lord Vishnu is also metaphorical too, you know. Where have the scientists ever seen a snake? Someone, you know, some blue guy laying down on a snake. You know, the universe is, and also someone being born from a lotus flower. You know, like I was describing in class the other day, it unravels like that. The whole faith in Krishna consciousness can really unravel it. So, but you have people who've sort of picked the intermediate point. But, you know, in the spiritual world, you know, Krishna's dancing with the gopis, but in the material world, you know, so in other words, they're picking and choosing what to believe in. And ultimately, that means they're accepting themselves as the authority. They're positing themselves as the authority. And even sometimes they take Bhaktivinoda Thakur's words out of context. Like, for example, Bhaktivinoda Thakur analyzed the different demons in Krishna Lila, how each one represented an anartha. Like, you know, Putana represents the bogus guru. You know, she looks good and very attractive, but she's poison, you know. That's Putana. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, you know, if we concentrate on these particular pastimes that illustrate particular anarthas and the conquering of anarthas by Krishna's actions or Balaram's actions, then we can help, this will help us conquer our own anarthas. So sometimes people take that out of context and say, well, these are just metaphorical demons. It happens. I mean, what can I say? I mean, people do this. There's different varieties of faith that people have, you know, and then picking and choosing. Of course, as I mentioned before, Bhaktivinoda Thakur did talk about how the demons represented certain anarthas, but simply because they represent certain anarthas doesn't mean that they weren't there. The demons actually were there, but they also represented anarthas. And sometimes you can have something that's very real, but it represents something. It represents something too. Like you have a sign on the road, very real. It says "caution, merging traffic." So it's telling you to be cautious. But if you don't follow it, you'll get a ticket or you'll hit a car. So you know, there's a lesson to be learned by seeing it, but there's also a practical application. So sometimes when we have allegorical stories. It doesn't mean that stories with an allegorical meaning, it doesn't mean that those stories are simply allegorical. They can actually have a real meaning. Some stories in the Bhagavatam are allegorical, like the Puranjana story. You know, there wasn't a person actually named Puranjana. Puranjana means every man. Who are you? I'm every man. And Puranjana is going to all the different gates of the city, Navadware Pure Dehi. That means all the different apertures in the body to enjoy. And so, you know, that's obviously, you know, from the context and everything, and Narada Muni is telling it, it's allegorical. But most of the descriptions in the Vedic literature are actual, factual descriptions. So it takes really a leap of faith to be able to accept many things. I mean, and so therefore, sometimes when preaching to people or approaching people who are not part of the Krishna conscious movement, we have to be careful what we talk about. I mean, if you go to the university and say, you know, there's God is, you know, laying down on the serpent bed and by his breathing out, all the universes are coming out in seed form. I mean, that may be a little challenge for the people at the university to deal with. So then you present basic philosophy, like, well, you're not your body, you know, there's karma. These things are all common sense to people. Anyway, so devotees generally do have to deal with this challenge to their faith. You know, sometimes that's called the dark night of the soul, where you have this real challenge. Your empirical understanding is contradicting what Shastra is saying. And it's something that really has to be reconciled with the devotees, of course. You know, the way I've reconciled it, of course, is that I understand there's a lot of things I don't see in this world, or not only in this world, the spiritual world. And therefore, you have the literature, Vedic literature, presenting things from a higher perspective, from Krishna's perspective, you know, what's going on. I mean, just like during World War II, you had these natives in the islands in the South Pacific, and they were just amazed at seeing Americans landing there, you know, trying to help fight with the Japanese. And they actually, you know, just didn't understand the technology or understand what was going on. And they began to worship the Americans as gods, because the Americans would distribute candy, chocolate, and things like that that they hadn't eaten before. And so, you know, they just didn't understand or have the education. So their ability to comprehend what was going on was severely limited. So our ability to comprehend, even, you know, beyond the realm of sense perception. Also, there's another statement too, that if you don't, as far as perception, if you don't expect something sometimes, or if you're not aware of something, you won't even perceive something in front of your face. You have to really be acquainted with that particular phenomena to be able to perceive it. That happens sometimes. I mean, there was even some description that when natives actually saw these big ships on the horizon, they couldn't identify them or understand what they were, because it was beyond their realm of experience. So anyway, so this is something that devotees have to pass through, this sort of like test of faith. So getting back to this point here, that our understanding of the Vedas is to understand the direct meaning of the Vedas, whereas you have many other people, groups, like the impersonalists who Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu talked with in Benares, like Prakasananda Saraswati, who took the indirect meaning of the Vedic literatures, especially the Vedanta. And as soon as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explained the direct meaning to them, they admitted that actually all along we've been accepting something that's doesn't fit the Vedanta. In other words, the Vedanta or the Vedas are a very consistent whole. And when you take the personal understanding, everything fits together. And when you take the impersonal understanding, it's like puzzle pieces that don't fit to the, it's like trying to fit pieces of puzzle where they don't belong. Because I used to do that when I was young, with putting together puzzles. I get so frustrated. I'd squeeze the pieces into a place where they just didn't belong. I'd say, I'm finished with the puzzle. My mother would say, you didn't do it. Because I got so frustrated with the damn puzzle. You know, you have these 5,000 piece puzzles. So basically the impersonalist followers of Prakasananda, they actually admitted that they were accepting the indirect interpretation. Also, Sarvabhava Bhattacharya, after he presented the indirect interpretation of the Vedic literatures to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu for 7 days, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, I understand the Vedas, but I don't, Vedanta, and I don't understand anything you said. Which is interesting. And even there's scholars, mundane scholars, who study the Vedanta and say the Vedanta Sutra in particular, is that basically theistic. You know, mundane scholars study it and they come to it because that, it fits in, it's consistent with all the verses. But when they present that to people from India, the people from India get upset because it interferes with their impersonalistic understanding. So even logically, the Vedas are consistent whole. So this is one point here. So anyway, so you have men who manufacture their own way of acting without reference to the Vedas, and I'm adding here, referencing the Vedas in an indirect fashion according to their own interpretation. And these people commit sinful actions. Unless you follow the Vedas, you are committing sinful actions. I mean, some people, I'll give you one example of how people misinterpret certain statements in the Vedas or use the Vedas to even commit sinful activities. One way is that people in the West, sometimes you have Indians in the Western world who eat cows, and they say, well, according to the Vedas, we're not supposed to eat cows, but these species in the West are not cows. They're adhanas. They're a different species. I mean, they come up with so many mental concoctions in order to justify their activities. Okay, so then there is another statement here. Therefore, all of them commit sinful actions and are punishable. Let's reference the last verse. It says, the previous verse, Prabhupada says, or the translation says, everyone engaged in fruitive activities is suitable to be subjected to punishment according to his sinful acts. So this is also a very interesting statement, because understanding that those who are pious or perform pious activities are not punished for pious activities. So how can we say everyone is punishable? This is explained in the Bhagavad Gita, where in the 14th chapter, I believe it's verse 10, where Krishna says that the modes of nature are continually struggling for control of the living entity. He says sometimes the mode of passion becomes prominent, defeating the mode of goodness and ignorance. Sometimes the mode of ignorance becomes prominent, defeating the mode of passion and goodness, etc. In this way, the modes are continually in flux. In other words, that you may be acting piously right now, but there is no surety that you will remain. In fact, it is for sure you will not be able to remain in the mode of goodness, because the modes of nature will ultimately affect you in this world. Karanam guna sangasya sadasad janma jonisha. There is no stable position in the modes of nature. That's the point I'm making. You may be in the mode of goodness, but then, like Ajamil. Okay, here's an example. Ajamil's walking around, minding his business, doing service for his Gurudev. Hare Krishna, like that. He looks up, boom, and he sees the Shudra, embraces the Shudrani, prostitute, whatever. And he associates with the mode of ignorance. He didn't plan it, isn't it? He didn't plan to do that. It just happened. Of course, it was Krishna's arrangement, we understand, to show him that he wasn't as advanced as he actually was. I thought he was. So he just looked, boom, and all of a sudden, mode of ignorance desires developed in his heart. He was a pure Brahmin in the beginning, right? Then all of a sudden, wow, gotta have her, gotta have her. Jayato vishak pumsam sangustesha bajayate sangat sanjayate kama kama gorda bajayate. And then he ultimately got the prostitute, did so many sinful activities. Of course, he was saved at the end, as we're hearing described in this particular chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So the point is, there's no stable position. It's not that someone's pious and he'll remain pious. Ultimately, he'll be dragged down in the lower modes of nature. And of course, someone who's lower modes of nature will be someday become pious too. That's interesting. Avritam gyanamaitena gyanino nichavayana kamarupena kuntiya dushprena lenicha. That's, a person is forced to act helplessly according to the modes of material nature. No one can refrain from action even for a moment. And that's also what Prabhupada mentions here. Let's see. Where did I read that? One who is accepted in a material body cannot be inactive, and sinful action is inevitable for one acting under the modes of material nature. Exactly what it says in the purport. It's inevitable. Unless one takes the Krishna consciousness, but one has to be still very attentive. It's not that, you know, I'm a devotee, mam chiyo bhyavacharene bhakti yogena sevate, sagunam samatichaitan brahma bhuyayi kalpate. I'm a devotee, I've transcended the modes. No. That would be nice. Unless you're very attentive, Lord Kapiladev describes You may be a devotee in the mode of ignorance, passion, or goodness. The third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Kapiladeva describes different qualities of devotees who are in different modes. And devotee in the mode of ignorance is envious, violent, angry, a separatist. In the mode of passion, also very similar qualities of passion and ignorance. And in good mode, in the mode of goodness, just wants to get liberated, wants to get the hell out of the material world. But a transcendental devotee just wants to please Krishna, manma, janmani, janmani. So anyway, I think you get the idea. So even as devotees, we can be affected by the modes of nature. So we have to be very, very careful and introspective. In other words, we have to look within our hearts to see why we're thinking a particular way. We can't just be reactive to certain situations in the material world. I mean, obviously reactive, we can get angry or lusty. You know, there are certain reactions that naturally occur due to having a material body in the material world. It just happens. But we have to be able to be checking these reactions using the intelligence. You know, control the lower self with the higher self. That's Krishna consciousness. Then we can actually transcend the modes. Mamchiyo vyabhicharena. So the point is that one who is engaged in full devotional service, not 100% of the time, he's transcended the modes. It's not that simply you take an initiation and the modes don't touch you anymore. I wish it worked like that. We'd have a bunch of pure devotees here. But it's not. So anyway, these are some of the explanations of some of the things that are being discussed here in this particular, or these particular verses. Any questions or comments? Yes.
You said that we can't be reactive, but can we sometimes use the reactions in our favor, like put ourselves in a particular circumstance that's favorable to devotional service, like in the association?
Yeah, but that requires intelligence, not simply reaction. You know, reaction, you know, how we react to certain stimuli in this material world can oftentimes get us in trouble. It's like when the doctor, you know, hits your knee, just to find out about your reflexes. One time I kicked a doctor in the face. Anyway, so, I had to apologize. But anyway, so we have reflexes, and because of our conditioned nature, you know, our previous nature habits, then there's these reflexes to certain things that happen. We have to have the intelligence always on alert. You know, 911. Is this reaction appropriate? I mean, sometimes reactions are appropriate. It's not always inappropriate. Let's say if I'm walking down the street and someone attacks you and my reaction is to defend you. That's an appropriate reaction. It's not that I have to sit and think, what is appropriate in this particular circumstance? Should I just allow him to get beaten up? That's his karma. Maybe he'll learn a good lesson and, you know, advance in devotional service. We have to see beyond the immediate. We have to see Krishna behind every action, even the action of the dacoits. No, I mean, at certain times, immediate reaction is appropriate. But generally, you know, with anger, it's usually not appropriate. It's usually not appropriate with anger. So we have to just think, hey, is this appropriate? Is this pleasing to Krishna? What is the goal of this? Will it accomplish what I want?
Can we still transcend?
Yes. Take a time out. Say, time out.